If you would be so kind as opening your material again to the third paper titled A Short Historical Background of 508 and 538 as related to the establishment of papal supremacy. And we should maybe spend some half an hour at least getting your reaction and maybe even some suggestions. So I will not read the other papers intended for tonight. You can do it by yourself. And if later on you have questions on, I understand that Wednesday morning we will have some kind of question-answer period. Is it right? Within our church, many people are challenging our understanding of these periods of 508 and 538. And they go to some of the basic history books of the Christian era or whatever the period is, but that covers this kind of... And they say, well, the historians usually do not even mention those dates, 508 and 538. Why are you still keeping insisting in these periods as the fulfillment or the starting point of some prophetic periods? What I would like to suggest to you is that if you take this period in, or these dates, I better say, in isolation, they will not make sense. If you just pick up 508, and now, what happened? And 538, you will not take much sense out of this kind of approach. But if you study there, in the whole process of the development of papal supremacy, then I believe that those were really crucial points, not the starting point, probably not the most important point, but a key point at the end of a process there. You will see, in regard to 508, I call the attention of the conversion of Christianity, of Constantine. And this is very important. He pretended to be converted, but actually he was just baptized later on in his life. But anyway, he saw that he had no other option. He could not move against the growing Christian community. He needed support also. So he decided to play the game. Now I am a Christian, but I didn't leave my pagan beliefs. So that's the way how it works. But really that was a major turning point for Christians. Another one not always mentioned is Augustine's book, famous book, The City of God. Actually, that book was to solve a problem, a crisis that the church was facing in his days. But many historians really say that that book became, how can I say, started the ideology or the ground basis of what would become the Roman Catholic theocracy on earth. So there he put really the idealistic program of what should take place. You have later on the conversion of Clovis. And, of course, he became also a Christian there and so on. And in 507, he declared war against one of the Arian heretical tribes, so to say. And he made even a promise there, if he would become victorious out of that, he really would... also dedicate his life to the church. And let's just read a little bit on this date here. You have on page 4, the year AD 508. In 507, Clovis declared war on the Visigoths. He was the aggressor, and for him it was a war of religion to free Gaul from the Arian heretics. He mustered his troops and made a vigorous speech to them. "It grieves me that these Arians should hold a part of Gaul. Let us march with the help of God and reduce their country to subjection." Undoubtedly, the religious element was very powerful in this war, on which, human speaking, the prevalence of the Catholic or the Arian creed in Western Europe depended. After his victory in 508, Clovis received special honors from Rome, according to August Dumas. In 508, while returning from the conquest, Clovis came to Tours, offering his gifts to Saint Martin. He saw coming an embassy from Constantinople. He received, according to Gregory of Tours, from the Emperor Anastasius, the diploma of consul. In the Basilica of Saint Martin, he dressed himself with a purple tunic and placed on his head a diadem. Then, riding a horse, he threw some pieces of gold and silver to the people assembled on the road. From that time on, he was called Consul and Augustus. In reality, Clovis appeared as one of the great creative spirits who gave a new direction to the current history. He was the founder of the first barbarian monarchy, which was fully able to resist successfully the last shocks of invasion and to endure for many centuries, and which became the ardent supporter of papacy during the early Middle Ages. And then you have another statement that says, Clovis was the first to unite all the elements from which the new social order was to be founded, namely the barbarians who he established in power, the Roman civilization to which he rendered homage and received the insignia of patriarch and of consul from the Emperor Anastasius, and finally the Catholic Church, with which he formed the fruitful alliance which was continued by his successors. And so the Council of Orleans had sanctioned this alliance by recognizing Clovis as the protector of the Church, whose immunities he confirmed in this same council. The Pope had already written to him, "The Lord has provided for the needs of the Church by giving her for defender a prince armed with a helmet of salvation. Be do always for her a crown of iron, and she will give thee victory over thy enemies." So you have other important points. I will just read here the conclusion of this section. So, from what has been said thus far, we might conclude that the conversion of Constantine was the turning point which allowed Christianity to become the official religion of the Roman Empire. Second, Augustine's City of God provided the philosophical ideal which inspired papacy in its building of a temporal power to conquer the world. Third, the conversion of Clovis I opened the doors for the political ecclesiological unification that was needed to support the Roman Catholic pretensions during the Middle Ages. And fourth, Clovis' war and final victory of the Arian Visigoths in 508 represents an extremely important step in providing an effective army to the Roman Catholic Church to punish the so-called heretics. So, did they have already pretensions or intentions of supremacy before? I mean the Roman Catholic Church? Definitely. But were they able, strategically speaking, of using it or implementing it? Not yet. They needed an army. And so, some people use just the statements of papacy, of some of the popes on this topic, saying, well, this is more important than something else. But something is to have the intention. Another thing is to be able to carry it on. It's the same thing as some people in our midst used to say that the apostolic letter of John Paul II, the one on Sunday observance, I forgot, Dies Domini. Well, this is really, it's already the Sunday law. No, this is just the intention of the Pope, that really we should implement and go back to Sunday and so. But in reality didn't take place. It's only when civil power will carry on the intention that it really becomes important. And that the same principle you should use also in regard to the many statements of Roman Catholicism in regard to papal supremacy and domain in the world of those days. Well, let's go to the next there. You have the historical background to 538. And here you find a very interesting point. I mentioned some of the ecclesiastical developments here, but especially Pope Symmachus. He was charged of many problems, even adultery and taking over in an illegal way some of the possessions of the church and so on. It was really a shameful situation. And now came the point where he should be handled. But he was not really very interested in being judged by the emperor or even by other bishops. And finally, things really were covered up. And then came up some kind of statement that really the Pope cannot be judged by anybody else in this world, neither the civil power nor other bishops, but he is really the representative of God on earth. And so, and this is a very important point for the Pope's authority. Well, if he is free to do whatever he can do or is willing to do, and nobody can touch him, what you can do? So he is above everybody else. Then you have Emperor Justinian I, who became emperor of the eastern segment of the Roman Empire. You know, we addressed a little bit the western part, and now the eastern part, known as the Byzantine Empire. And it's interesting, you have his corpus, juris, civilis, and so on. And he also recognized the Bishop of Rome as having full authority. And you have the correspondence there between some statements by Justinian and the reaction of the Pope also recognizing as his faithful servant and so on. The year 538 is important. Many important events took place, as already mentioned, prior to 538, preparing the way for the papal supremacy of the Dark Ages. Although Justinian had recognized officially the ecclesiastical primacy of the Pope in 533, the Roman Church was not yet politically free to exercise its supremacy. Since the fall of the Roman Empire, 476, Rome was always under the rule of an Arian kingdom. And so you have some historical developments. And then, therefore, in 538, for the first time since the end of the Western Imperial line, the city of Rome was free from the domination of an Arian kingdom. It does not mean that at that time the Ostrogoth Empire collapsed, but the grave of the Ostrogothic monarchy in Italy was dug by the defeat of this siege. And it's interesting that in that year, 538, was held the third synod of ordines, where the assembled bishops declared their aim to reestablish the old laws of the church and the passing of new ones. And among its 33 canons, there was one, Canon 13, in which he said that Christians must not marry with Jews, nor even eat with them. And another, Canon 28, that says, it is a Jewish superstition that it is unlawful to ride or drive on Sunday, or to do anything for the decoration of the house or person. But field laborers are forbidden, so that people might be able to come to church and worship. If anyone acts otherwise, he is to be punished, not by the laity, but by the bishop. And so you have even a certain kind of Sunday law here involved in that very same year. Let's just go to the conclusions there. And prior to the conclusions, you have the conclusions of this section, the top of page 10. So, from the historical background of 538, we might conclude that, first, in spite of the fact that Symmachus had legally submitted himself sometimes to the heretical Arian king Theodoric, he not only saw himself as superior to the secular ruler, but was even called the judge in the place of God and the vicegerent of the Most High. Second, Justinian I did not only call the Pope as the head of all the holy churches, but also legalized officially the ecclesiastical supremacy of the Pope. And third, it was only in 538 that the city of Rome became free from the domination of any heretical Arian kingdom, and the Roman Church was able to develop more effectively its ecclesiastical supremacy. The following statement helps to clarify the relationship between 533 and 538, as mentioned previously. Although this legal recognition of the Pope's ecclesiastical supremacy was dated in 533, it is obvious that the imperial edict could not become effective for the Pope so long as the Arian Ostrogothic kingdom was in control of Rome and the greater part of it, and the greater part of Italy. Not until the rule of the Goths was broken could the papacy be free to develop fully its power. In 538, for the first time since the end of the Western Imperial line, the city of Rome was free from the domination of an Arian kingdom. In that year, the Ostrogothic kingdom received its death blow. Although the Ostrogoths survived some years longer as a people, that is why 538 is a more significant date than 533. Conclusions? And before the conclusions, let me just go to the next slide. It's not in this paper. You will find here some remarks at least, in regard to to 1798. Also, we have a context to this guy, to this date. And I think that a major point is the Lisbon earthquake. We usually, some people say, but the Lisbon earthquake was not really the most important earthquake. There are other stronger ones. But the thing is not so much the intensity of the earthquake, but the meaning attached to it. When took place that earthquake? It was not, and it's interesting, I just saw a book that deals with the Lisbon earthquake and some other. There were several prophecies among Portugal and some French people at that time. Some saying, well, the All Saints Day of this year, something will happen. And the day just passed and nothing happened. And later on, somebody was saying about the other one. But you have to keep in mind that really Roman Catholicism took over much of Europe, and especially Portugal. And they believed that the Roman Catholic Church provided them with a shelter, with that kind of strength they needed to survive and so on. And on the day of All Saints, no saints could help the church. And while the priests and believers were worshiping in their church, the worst happened really. So it really shaken the power of Roman Catholicism. You have, of course, the French Revolution, anti-religious enlightenment, and finally, what you already know. Conclusions. Analyzing the history of the Christian Church, one can see that from the 4th to the 6th century, several important steps were taken in the process by which the Roman Church became more and more powerful in secular issues, culminating in the union of church and state. During the time of Constantine, Christianity received freedom of worship and became an official religion of the state. The emperors that succeeded him tried more and more to make Christianity the exclusive religion of the state. After the sake of Rome by the Visigoths in 410, Augustine wrote his famous The City of God, in which he outlined the Catholic ideal of a universal church in control of a universal state, providing the theoretical basis for medieval papacy. The conversion of Clovis, king of the Franks, was a very significant event leading towards the unification of Western Europe to support papacy during the first part of the Middle Ages. And Clovis' war against the Arian Visigoths and his victory over them in 508 represented an important step in providing an effective army to the Roman Catholic Church be able to punish the so-called heretics. In spite of the fact that Pope Symmachus was strongly accused and had to submit himself to the judgment of an heretical Arian king, Theodoric, he considered himself superior to the secular ruler and was even called the judge in place of God and vicegerent of the Most High. Although in 533, Justinian, emperor of the Byzantine Empire, had already recognized the ecclesiastical supremacy of the Pope when he called him the head of all the holy churches. And in the following year, 534, such a status was officially legalized in the second edition of the Codex. It was only in 538 that the city of Rome became free from the domination of any heretical Arian kingdom. And the Roman Church was able to develop more effectively its ecclesiastical supremacy. The present study suggests that if we isolate the events of 508 and 538 from this historical context, there seems to be no plausible justification for the acceptance of such dates as the starting points to the prophetic periods of the 1290 and 1335 years and the 1260 years. However, if we consider those days in the light of the historical development of papal supremacy, there are convincing reasons to accept 508 as the starting point of the 1290 and 1335 years, and 538 as the beginning of the 1260 years. You know, this is just more a collection of sources. It's not really a developed paper, but at least I hope it can be useful for if somebody wants to look more fully into those dates. Let me just add that there is a doctoral student at Andrews now working with this very same subject. His name is Jean Zukowski, and he is really building the historical context of 508 and 538 using Latin sources and some other ones, because I used more English sources and just, I think, one or so in Latin. But you might expect something far better to show up than just this simple material here. The last paper here, of course, there will be another presentation on this topic, so we will not touch it, but just to highlight it, the title is the 1290 and the 1335 days of Daniel 12. And in this short article, I state why I don't believe that we can use those time periods and apply them in future fulfillment related with the National Sunday Law, as some put it, and the close of probation, and so on. And the first reason is, I believe this futuristic theory is based on a partial and biased reading of the spirit of prophecy, based on a statement that is ambiguous and does not really say what they want the text to say, or the passage. Second, the futuristic theory breaks the prophetic literary parallelism of the book of Daniel. And third, this theory rests on a non-biblical interpretation of the Hebrew term tamid, daily or continuous. Fourth, the theory reflects the Jesuit futuristic interpretation of the Roman Catholic Counter-Reformation. And fifth, the theory disregards the warnings of the spirit of prophecy against the attempt to extending the fulfillment of any time prophecy beyond 1844. So, if you are interested, you might read it for your personal benefit. Okay, let's have some time for questions. We have some 20 minutes left. Is there a mic?
All right. 538 was tied to the overthrow of the Arian Empire. Now, this is, I've been vexed by this for a while, so hopefully it's a little bit ancillary to what you talked about tonight, but hopefully you can give some light here. Okay? The 538 is tied to the overthrow of the Arians in 538.
Let me, before you go ahead, the questions or your observations might not be just of my last presentation. I am even more interested in the first one, even. But go ahead.
Okay, well, yeah, I'm more interested in the second.
Fine.
So anyway, it's related to the overthrow of the Arians in 538. So this is my question. It's no secret that there's been debate whether it's the Vandals Ostrogoths or the Huruls or the Vandals Ostrogoths or the Visigoths. So there's a debate over who the third horn of the three horns that were uprooted. And I could quote, for instance, Angel Rodriguez in his book Future Glory, where he specifically says, Adventist commentators differ concerning the identity of the third power. So here's my question. you have some Adventists saying it's the Vandals, and I'm not a great historian, obviously, or I'd probably have an answer to this. You have Vandals, Ostrogoths, and Hurles. You have other Adventist historians saying you have Vandals, Ostrogoths, and Visigoths, and this is pretty easily documented. So if we're tying 538 to the overthrow of that third power, okay, but we're not settled on who those three powers are, and it might even appear to be four, then what do we do with that? I mean, kind of the way my brain has worked, and 538 isn't a question for me because what Ellen White says, and it seems to make sense, and everything you've said about the build-up to it, that makes sense. My question is, how do we relate to the fact that there are four, really, powers that were uprooted by the papacy? You know, you have some Adventists saying it's the Hurles, the Vandals, and the Ostrogoths. Somebody say it's the Hurles. You see where I'm coming from here?
Yeah. I don't know if we have a final answer to this question.
Okay.
But I think that we should really wait for this study to show up. I think that can really help a lot in this. Well, you have a...
The Hurles and the Ostrogoths were Arians. Both were opposed to the Pope. It made no sense to consider that they were one Arian power dethroning another Arian power, to consider something that the Pope would do, or those who defended the Pope would do, to dethrone Arian powers which were opposing the Pope. This is the reason why I cannot consider the Hurles as the third power in the kingdoms. I believe that they are the Vandals, the Visigoths, and the Ostrogoths.
Okay.
I discuss this matter in my book, The Seals and the Trumpets, in a section dealing with the time of supremacy of the Antichrist. I deal in detail with some discussions of these subjects.
Okay. Thank you.
I am not controlling this.
Well,
I don't know who is... Please ask me on that.
You are the deacon now.
On page 21, paragraph 2, after you quote Pearson, you say here, some Adventist theologians recognize the lack of biblical support to such theories as the fallen human nature of Christ and humanless, sinless perfection. No effort whatsoever could inhibit some Adventist offshoots from independent ministries of using these theories as a test of fellowship against the church and its leadership. And if you turn the page, you say here,
page
22, top. Some independent ministries accuse the domination of being an apostasy for not recognizing such tendencies in him. I'd like to know what you think. Do you think the denomination changes position on the nature of Christ? It's okay if you think so. I just want to know historically. We talked about the philosophy of history. Is it honest and understandable that most Adventists, early 1900s and later, took a fallen nature of Christ view, and by 1950s and the... infamous book that came out, big debate on that one.
Questions on Doctrine.
That the position is that the church did change its view on that. Not saying it's wrong if we changed our view. I mean, I'm just wondering, do you think we did? And regardless of which view you hold on the nature of Christ, just wanted your thoughts on that.
I know that when I was reading it, I was imagining that this question could be raised. Within the church, within the church we have both positions. And of course, some people, I think, in my view at least, make too much out of A.T. Jones. And of course, you have M.L. Andreessen and so on. And some other people also. This is a different discussion, really, to deal with the nature of Christ. My main point here is really, is while there is a discussion within the church on this point, is something. But once you put it and say, when somebody do not agree with this point, you are in apostasy. This is a major, it's a really a problem. And in some places of the world, it's the church is being regarded as in apostasy because do not accept this kind of view. And so, you know very well that Herbert Douglas and Mervyn Maxwell and some other people kept this view within the church, and we have several ones, and in a good stand with the church. And really, you can say that they are really actual Seventh-day Adventists. But, you know, the problem is that some of the so-called, either you like or not, those offshoot movements, they really say the church is really has become Babylon because left that kind of position or so on. Within the development of SDA doctrines, you will see many changes. One example, for instance, is the development of our understanding of Armageddon. If I take a view on Armageddon and I would keep that view, I would be in trouble because the world changes. Well, you can argue also saying, well, but Armageddon is something that really has to do with prophetic interpretation, and the nature of Christ is something is more stable in a certain sense and should be really well understood. But you know the classical discussion on this topic. You see, if we say that Christ is not as like us, we are in trouble. But if we make Christ exactly as us, then comes the question. And so why do I need a Savior and he didn't need a Savior? Exactly. And at the same time, there are difficult questions. Another one is, if God, like the book of Hebrews mentions, and also some of Ellen White's books, at least two of those, God is a consuming fire to sin. How could a sinful human nature, a holy sinful human nature, coexist with a fallen human nature without consuming it? You know, we might avoid these questions and saying, well, I don't touch those questions because I am in holy ground. But anyway, some people do not see in the same way. But anyway, my point here is not blaming whoever. But you know, almost we have to realize something. At least as the vast majority of the leadership of the church do not endorse this view. And this is the reason why the independent ministries are angry against the denomination in a certain sense, saying, you are no longer faithful to the historic Adventism. And so, whatever side you take, I think we cannot come to the point of saying, well, the church is in apostasy, like there is apostasy within the church, but the church is not in apostasy. And from my paper, you will see immediately that I am on the other side. I have difficulties in accepting this kind of approach of the human falling, the fallen human nature of Christ.
I think probably for me, the value of that book, Questions on Doctrine, is Appendix A in the back, which is a statement on the nature of Christ. And actually, the counsel in the back of that is silence is golden. We don't know everything on that subject. We know a little bit. We know what is revealed, but what isn't revealed is not for us, so to speak. And I think we need to be careful not to make it an issue among us of divisiveness, but rather let's accept what we do know, and by faith we'll find out the rest when we get to heaven.
Excellent.
I noticed in your first presentation, I really appreciated the historical survey of all of the issues. What path do you see to move forward? Because the last little section there was the time of controversy, right? So what path do you see moving forward that we can take as leaders beyond 2004 to sort of sharpen the focus on a biblical eschatological picture? How can we do better in the future? How can we move beyond, you know, taking a literalistic turkey view or you know, fighting fights that we don't need to fight? How can we sharpen the focus and move forward in our day and age from your perspective as a historian?
We need to avoid the mistakes and to keep with the right interpretation. Is it not easy to state? The problem is how we define it, what is really the line and what is not.
Okay,
yeah, but... Yeah, no, I understand. I was just...
You know, here's the thing. Like, I've been teaching Revelation in the at Arise, and one of the questions that we've wrestled with is, how do you teach the book of Revelation in the Seventh-day Adventist Church in our day and age? Do you give them all a Daniel in Revelation and tell them, you know, memorize it and call that good? Or, you know, Daniel in Revelation by Uriah Smith, because that's sort of like the standard of orthodoxy and you don't get yourself in any trouble? Or... Where's the line? And I don't. I mean, I love. I'm a mark of the beast preaching, you know, in time guy. And I want to call people out of Babylon. And I'm right there with us. But I'm just. I personally struggle sometimes studying the Book of Revelation because it's like, how much am I allowed to think? Am I the only one that has this struggle? I don't know. And I don't mean that in a disrespectful or. I love our history. I love our connection to the past, but.
You are not the only one who speaks about the mark of the beast. At Andrews, we had a series called The Countdown to the Showdown, who also addressed Revelation 13. And it was outstanding. It was published in a book form later on, and you know the book. But, you know, I think that we understood, I think that we learned some lessons. In the first, the second period I mentioned, from 1862 to 1950, I think that that period, and you might go even earlier with Millerism and also early Sabbatarian Adventism, we had a tendency to look always to every single sign or whatever event took place as a sign of the second coming. And of course we need to have the whole thing in mind, the scenario. But if we keep identifying precisely one point here, another one there, we face the risk of having to change too frequently our position. And this is the point. And I think that we should try to avoid it. You know, after one Armageddon, to other Armageddon, another one, and so on, and no one of those Armageddons succeeded. Finally, we said, well, Armageddon is a spiritual war. And then the problem was solved. Well, this is not a rationalization, because some people say that we did the same thing with 1844. We put it on the spiritual realm, and so nobody can touch it. Nobody sees it. And so the disappointment was explained, and that was enough. Of course, we believe that there is a biblical basis to the transition in Christ's heavenly ministry, and it's just not a way out of the embarrassment in which we were. So the same thing, I think that at that point, we reached the balance. If I could say so, I think that the Christ-centered approach to eschatology is the closer to the balance. But when I go into the existential rereading of our eschatology, you empty eschatology and you are left almost without anything. And this is the most dangerous situation for us. If one is a legalistic approach, the other one would be the other side, where you are left without any hope. So hope is to be related with Christ. But I think that there is something else than just saying, well, I am in good shape with Christ. We have to have hope to this world. And I think if I would go, I have a conviction that we are living in the last days. Not because I point out one specific sign here and another one there, but the main trends, the tendencies of the world. And I would just, as a testimony, mention a few of them. For instance, when Ellen White wrote A Great Controversy, you will see that at that time in American church history, Roman Catholics, Protestants, and even spiritualistics could not even get along together. What do you see today? You know, Hollywood and the world is not an old trend, but you see how much of our culture is devil-related or satanic or so on. They are not ashamed of their flag. They speak openly that the demons are in this world and those ones who come from outside. And so how much of demonism you have in our culture today, in the movies, in the whatever you want to say, even the games for children. Yes? Some people say that Harry Potter even passed the Bible as a bestseller. This is something amazing. So this is a recent trend, as in a general one. You have also our moral stand. But one of the greatest signs is not just the ecumenical movement and spiritualism, but you see also what happens within the church. From my perspective, you can write our church history from the pre-internet period and the post-internet period. Some of us are not so much into internet, or at least use internet just as needed. But you know that not everybody does the same. When Ellen White stated, if I am not mistaken in my interpretation, that in the last days all winds of false doctrines would be blowing, and the test would come to every person as an individual. I couldn't explain it because some people are so far away from from the places where things really happen. But today our world is a world community, and everything is really, every doctor, every truth is available, and each error the same to everybody in this world. You just turn on your computer and you can have as many heresies as you want to have in your collection and believe. I don't know. I imagine that your field here, your conference, is not being targeted in this way. But in some places of the world, and especially the place from where I come, the problem of the Trinity and the personality of the Holy Spirit is a major, devastating problem. 30 years ago, I couldn't imagine that some people in our ranks would consider as more trustworthy the beliefs of the Jehovah's Witnesses on this matter than our own teaching. And so, the world is prepared. And if this is not a shaking, I don't know what it is. Do we have to expect something even worse than this? And I made a presentation once on Ellen White at that field conference in Turkey and Greece for the GC and the division leaders. And at that point, I mentioned one of these major challenges. I think that you can divide our church history. One of the major turning points is 1970, where liberalism really became strong. with a historical critical method. And then you have the mid-1980s, more precisely 1985, where the counter-reaction came into a more restorationistic fashion, where we restore today not only the right points, but also the errors, like Unitarianism, and so on. And then you have 1998, where the first website, anti-Ellen White and anti-church, really had an impact. And you know, it's amazing, sometimes we are not so fully aware of this. You know in how many languages the anti-Ellen White website displays their material. I don't know today, but some time ago it was 21 languages. And do you know in how many languages our Ellen White website operates? Just our holy English. You know, why these people are making a bigger impact? I think that we don't open our eyes in trying to provide answers to these challenges. We are seeing today in our world things that our past generation didn't see. I think that they saw signs of the second coming in single events here and there, pointing out one, but not the major, the macrocosmical trends of the world. And this is something recent in our history. Okay. The last one.
I want to respond to... Okay. He asked a question about how much freedom he had, and I thought maybe I ought to define that for him. He actually covered it quite nicely. The truth is, we've been right about most things.
So I spoke a lot and didn't answer the question.
Yeah, no, you did. You did. You actually covered it. Okay. You covered it in more precise language than I can. But we've been right. And we've been right not in particulars, but on world scope. The rise of the United States of America as the one superpower, the rise of the papacy, the wandering after the beast, all of those things we've been right on. So we got a lot to stand on, and we've got a lot to move on. And I think at this point in human history, as he was just nicely pointing out, we're beginning to see the accumulation, not just one or two here or there. We're beginning to see the accumulation, and it's beginning to look like a snowball. I think that we're probably should stay out of arguments as to, you know, I don't care if you studied, I think you ought to, but it really, at the end of the day, people aren't going to be prepared for eternity as to whether it was the Visigoths or the Heruli, and no disrespect for the position that was, that, you know, study it, look at it. So we've got those broad outlines. And the other thing is that the spiritual issues that he pointed out were built for us in the spirit of prophecy early on. It was some of the divergence, some of the people that didn't listen, i.e. Uriah Smith. And we have people today that are writing that don't listen again to the spirit of prophecy. I think the spirit of prophecy is light. I think it has authority. And I think it gives guidance to keep us on track so that we don't wave off on some. Some of the problem among scholarship today, thank God for the good scholars, some of the problem on scholarship is two things. One, people want to make a name for themselves. So you want, you know, to do something different or against your church. Or two, there's non-Adventist reading you, and so you want to make sure that you don't offend them or you can still stay in the cool culture there. As Adventist preachers, our business is to convince, convict, and transform. And that's what the true preaching of these prophecies do. We're on good ground. That doesn't mean we understand every nuance. It also means that there's more and more light to burst from the Word of God. I'm grateful that our understanding of Armageddon is so much better than where Uriah Smith took us for a while. Because it fits, and it fits what's happening today. In other words, we see the benefit of the spirit of prophecy's outline of what Armageddon really is as we're watching now the developments worldwide. Right now, we're fuzzy on Islam, but we're going to have to get sharper on that, and we will. as we study and base it on the good basic principles. So it was a good question. I just wanted to give a little light to it because we are here to change the world because Jesus is coming. We have been right. We are right. We shall be right. Not in every nuance. Not that we haven't made some little detours. But where we're headed is true and firm.
Okay. There is somebody there. Okay. Let me just add something else. You know, as far as the crisis of the church always faced crisis. There was no time without crisis because the devil does not rest, does not take vacation. You take, but the devil not. And so, there were always crises, but those crises in the old time or the old days, they were successive. One crisis came and was replaced by another one. That was the trend, usually. Today, they are simultaneous. Some of the crises that were already in the grave just raised up and are still alive. You see how much of our crises today are church history related? How do we understand the 1919 Bible Conference? How do we understand the position of A.G. Daniels there? And then you have 1888, and you have the evangelical conferences of the 1950s, and so on. And all those things are still alive today. In the past, the crises were more geographically delimited. You know, this is the place where there is the big problem there. That's another one. But today, everything is available to everybody. So it's very difficult to point out the geographical configuration or delimitation of the crisis because it might be here, there, over there, like terrorism in a certain sense. Does Ellen White not speak about a globalization prior to the first coming of Christ? In the Desire of Ages, the first chapter? Does she not say that a globalization will take place prior to the second coming? So I think that we have some evidences, a big macrocosmic evidences, that the world is getting in shape precisely as Ellen White painted it would be in the last days.
If this is a question, it would be in a little bit going on with what Nathan Renner was saying. We're having a biblical prophetic symposium, and it seems that our forefathers, when they would study things, they did have freedom to bring things to the table. I think Islam is fuzzy, and that was where my question was going. In what forums are we trying to, you know, with upholding our historical interpretation, still trying to help people see the people we're studying with today, you know, what's going on in the world, because they ask us these questions. I mean, I saw how God used Islam as a whip or a corrective element in times past to the idolatrous church that it interacted with and conquered. And there's an idolatrous church that it's interacting with now that's being judged, if you will, by it. But that makes me almost feel like I don't want to be afraid, but am I making a multiple interpretation of a past event? Each one of those tensions had some degree or element in which it was almost true. And a lot of the things that, you know, we've seen come since the 1900s. But we don't want to enter in those errors again. So what kind of format do young searching theologians have where we get together and say, what do you think, without getting trapped with written words?
Well, if I understood well your question, is what should be done to have a certain kind of forum to discuss these ideas? Is this what you mean? I think that, you know, at the very beginning of the church, the forum was the review. You remember, some ideas were were sent over there, another one reacted, and so on. But today, the review, how many members do we have as a church? There is no way to follow this pattern anymore. So I think that the most important thing is what you are doing, to have like some meetings. And at this time, I think that we have more presentations than discussions. But I think that you can promote somewhere meetings that you can really with other pastors or ministers, so to share views and discuss and try to come to agreement based on the Bible and the spirit of prophecy without any problem. But this interaction, I think, is very important. If not at this meeting that's already planned, maybe in some other one. And in most of our symposiums or symposia or whatever you want to call or other gatherings, the problem is you listen a lot and you don't have so much opportunity to speak and maybe exchange ideas, maybe for the future.
One of the things that we don't do real well as a church is we don't get together with our brethren and study something. We go to the pulpit first before we've proved it and given anybody an opportunity to say something. Wait a minute, brother, slow up. And then hit us with 5 reasons why we're, or 1,000 reasons why we shouldn't have said what we do. But we think that we are anointed of God and we go straight to the pulpit before we think. We speak before we think, as a general rule. And then once you've said it, you have to defend yourself. And pride comes in there and nobody's willing to give, and we keep having these things keep coming around. What we need to do is get back to the old days when we go together, sit together. That's why we have these district things. We need to prescribe to each other what we're going to study next time. All go home and study it, not come and share from ignorance, but share from study when we get together in our districts, so that when we get there, we have a time. Some of the districts do that. They have a certain amount of time that they give to that, and then the rest of the time they do the business. But I think we need to, in these last days, we need to study and come to the table, all of us, having studied an area of concern, so that we can all give counsel. And in the multitude of counselors, there's some wisdom. But we go straight to the pulpit before we've tested some of these things and don't have a lot of counsel. I think that's where the danger comes. And then this pride thing swells up and we defend to the end because our pride has been wounded when somebody calls us to task on it, because we've put it in print or we've said it before we've tested it with the brethren. That's how the old brethren used to do things. They got together and they tested it with each other.
A good point. One of the greatest challenges that we are facing today is that people really study a lot in some places, but without principles of interpretation. The problem is not so much the acceptance of the Bible and Ellen White is in the past, but they decide to study, well, the Holy Spirit enlightens me, I have prayed. And so we are almost in that point of, the infallibility of prayer. I prayed and now I became infallible. And don't challenge my view. You know, no, this has been the problem. And I have been in dialogue with many people. Well, I have a good devotional life. I pray, so my conclusions are right. What do you want to do? So if we don't really try to help the church members and one another in trying to put the principles on the table, and then we have no common ground anymore to dialogue. And you know, William Miller, in his very first book published in 1833, he already in the preface of the book stated the principles of interpretation that led his study. And we have to do the same. We cannot just move by ourselves without any principle. Okay. God bless you. Thank you.
American Cassette Ministries is pleased to provide you with this presentation from the First Michigan Conference Bible Prophecy Symposium presented at their ministerial retreat at Camp Osabo, August 6 through 9, 2006. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International Copyright 2006, American Cassette Ministries. For the largest selection of authentic, genuine Adventist preaching available, visit our secure website at www.americancassette.org. Our latest catalog is online, plus thousands of other selections to choose from. We accept MasterCard, Visa, and Discover credit cards. You will find there is no compromise here at ACM. We've been maintaining the integrity of the Three Angels' messages since 1975. We request your prayers and continued tax-deductible financial support for this 501c3 nonprofit ministry so that we can continue helping prepare you and your loved ones to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.